Join Sam and Will as they bring the Bible's stories to life through historical evidence and try not to feel out of place in a car garage, all while bringing you Under the Hood.
Welcome to Under the Hood. I'm your host, Will. I'm here alongside Sam. Sam, what are we talking about today?
Today we're going to be talking about whether or not we can prove outside of the Bible whether or not Jesus was a historical figure and if he is who he claimed he was. And so all the archaeological, the ancient writings from the first century and second century about this figure that is the most monumental figure in all of history named Jesus of Nazareth. What can we find outside the Bible?
And especially today, we're not looking at, would you say, fans of Jesus or followers of Jesus. We're going to be looking at the hard stuff that says, okay, what do people outside of those who believe that he is who he says he is say about what he did?
Yeah, that's right. Most of the people that we're going to hear from today are people that are not excited about the spread of Christianity. In fact, if they had their ways, they would have stamped it out.
Okay, so we're going to start with some of the minor characters in the gospel, but ones that we can for sure prove due to things that have been dug out of the ground that they existed at least.
Yeah, so you don't hear about this in the news. It's not like this is going to be front page in the major newspapers around the world. But when you look, like, there's major characters that you find in the New Testament. And when you go and you look at archaeological evidence for them, it just reaffirms that these stories that we read about in the New Testament have some truth to them, right? Even outside of the Bible. So one of them is a guy who the Bible tells us is Jesus's brother. His name is James. And they discovered an ossuary box or an ossuary box. And what an ossuary box is a box that where you would put the bones of the deceased person. And so if you were to jump in a time machine, go back to first century Israel, you would be buried inside a tomb and they would leave your body in there to decompose during that time. And once your body decomposed, they would go in, gather your bones, and put your bones inside an ossuary box, and they would put the ossuary box where you can go and visit and do whatever. So you find these all over the place. And James had an ossuary box that they have discovered, and on the inscription, you find James, son of Joseph, brother of Jesus. Well, the skeptics come along and they say, that's way too on the nose. Like, yeah, old ossuary boxes, they would mention who you're the son of. So it would make sense to say James, the son of Joseph. And that fits the Bible because who's Jesus's father?
Joseph.
At least the earthly one. Yeah, Joseph. But to say brother of Jesus as well, it feels like a forgery. And so all the skeptics were like, oh, this has to be a forgery. Until they went and started looking at the microbial patina in the grooves of the inscription. And sure enough, they discovered this was authentic to the time period. And so there we have a validation that there's a James, that he's the brother of a Jesus and the son of a Joseph. Now, the likelihood that that's not the Holy Family seems pretty small to come from that time period as well. And so you come across another ossuary box, which is another famous figure of the New Testament, which is a guy named Caiaphas. And if you read in the New Testament, through the Gospels, Caiaphas jumps out as he's the high priest character. He's the one that is rallying up the people to crucify Jesus. He's the high priest who puts him on trial. And you find a very ornate ossuary box that is obviously from a wealthy person. And on there is the inscription, Joseph, son of Caiaphas. So we know that Caiaphas served as Jerusalem's high priest from 18 to 36 AD. We know that for sure, which is during the time when Jesus is going to be crucified. And Flavius Josephus, who's outside of the Bible, refers to him as Joseph, who was called Caiaphas of the high priesthood. And so on this ossuary box, no one doubts the validity, the veracity of this ossuary box. And here you have another figure. We have archaeological evidence of Herod the Great all over the place in Israel. He would build these grand monuments and level mountains to build fortresses, and we have a lot of evidence of Herod the Great. We have evidence of Herod Antipas, which we also find in the Gospels. We find evidence of Pontius Pilate. So like the Christian who's, you know, declaring their creed, we talk about how he was crucified under the orders of Pontius Pilate, and he was raised on the third day. We know that Pontius Pilate was the governor of Judea from 26 to 36 AD, right? Well, and you find evidence of him. Here you see, you know, a stone tablet that they discovered in Caesarea Maritima in 1961, and on there you see it mention Tiberium at the top. That's Emperor Tiberius. And then you see his name on the next level where you'd see the end of Pontius and Pilatus, which is talking about him. You find his signet ring that they've discovered. You also find references to John the Baptist in the ancient world. So one of the first century historians that worked for the emperor wrote about John the Baptist being this great figure. And listen to what Flavius Josephus wrote about John the Baptist and see if this sounds consistent with what the Bible presents. He wrote, some of the Jews thought that the destruction of Herod's army came from God, which is going to come later on, as a punishment of what he did against John. So we know that Herod beheaded John, and so they're thinking the punishment that came upon the Jews later by the Romans was punishment for that. And this John was called the Baptist, for Herod slew him, who was a good man, and he commanded the Jews to exercise virtue, both as to righteousness toward one another and piety toward God, and so to come to baptism. And so here you have these major characters, historical figures, from the time of Jesus's life, and you find them authenticated outside the scriptures. And we're going to find the same thing for Jesus as well.
Okay, so those are all those other figures in the Gospels. But now we get to Jesus. Do people really doubt that Jesus himself existed?
Most scholars, most academic scholars, the overwhelming majority of them are certain that Jesus existed. But when you go into the atheistic camps, the most famous atheists of the last century, I would say, throw up these arguments that, well, it's possible that he didn't exist at all. So the most famous atheist of the early 20th century was a guy named Bertrand Russell. And he wrote books like Why I'm Not a Christian. And he wrote this in that book. He says, historically, it's quite doubtful whether Christ ever existed at all. And if he did, we do not know anything about him, which is it's just an absurd thing. We know actually quite a lot about him, but what he's saying is anything that comes to us to affirm him, like the Gospels, we have to throw out. So Bertrand Russell would go around and say, we don't know anything about him if he existed at all. And some of the more recent atheistic, you know, evangelists, I would say, like Christopher Hitchens, has said stuff like this. He says, there's little or no evidence for the life of Jesus. At one speaking engagement, he said, Jesus of Nazareth is not a figure in history. There is no firm evidence that he existed. And Dawkins will admit that there's not a whole lot of people that would agree with this statement, but he says the evidence for his existence is pretty weak, which is absurd. So hold those comments, those suggestions in mind as we go through this the rest of this episode, because you'll see that argument that Jesus didn't exist, it's just absurd. And so what these guys are arguing or suggesting, which is absurd and most people agree that it's absurd, is that it's possible that Jesus didn't exist at all. And what I want to say is it's 100% certain, like even if you set aside the Bible, there's so much historical evidence that Jesus existed that that argument is totally absurd. But I want to press it even farther and say that given the evidence that we have outside of the Bible, you could make a really strong case that even outside of the sacred text, people recognized that there was something supernatural about this Jesus who existed.
All right, so where do we begin?
Well, let's begin with the enemies of Jesus who did not want Christianity to spread. So we'll start, for instance, with the Jews who felt like Christianity was blasphemous. This notion that God had a son, that God would become a man, that God was raised from the dead, that God was born of a virgin, all of those things in the first century, as it was spreading through Jewish communities, set off massive resistance, right? They thought that this was blasphemous. And you can understand why they did, that God would have a son who became a human and did all these things. And so they tried to stamp it out. And one of the things that they wrote, it's called the Babylonian Talmud. The Talmud is a collection of Jewish writings from scribes and priests. And they discuss what happened to Jesus. So they don't say, oh, he never existed, because that would have been the best argument, right?
Yeah.
You want to stamp out Christianity, just say, oh, he never existed. But they can't do that. Why? Because they're writing to an audience that existed at the time that had generational memories of this guy. You can't say he didn't exist. You'd have been laughed out of the room. And so what do they say? Oh, and by the way, they don't claim that he never did any of the miraculous things. Like they don't say, oh, he never raised the dead. He never did the miracles. He never, Listen to what they say in the Babylonian Talmud. They say Jesus was hanged, which is another word that they would use for crucified, on Passover Eve because he has practiced sorcery and led Israel astray. Let me ask you a question. They don't say he never did any of this stuff. They never say he never did the miraculous. Instead, they say, well, he definitely did some stuff that we can't explain, but it was evil. It was sorcery. Why would you claim that he did sorcery if he never did any of the miracles? When Islam comes about in the 7th century, they don't claim that Jesus wasn't miraculous. They try to co-opt it into Islam. They claim that he gave life to birds and that he was born of a virgin. They affirm so many of these things because it would have been impossible, given their collective memory of this, to say that it didn't happen. The same thing you could say for the Romans. Like, if there were two groups that wanted to stamp out Christianity in its early days, it was Judaism that saw this as a new sect coming out of it that was blasphemous and it was leading all of their people astray. And it was the Romans, who had emperors that were eager to stamp it out, that persecuted and killed a lot of Christians, right? And so listen to the arguments of the Romans that we have. What the Romans don't say is, he never did any of that stuff. All these miracles, they made it up. This is from Celsus the Skeptic. Like, this guy's known as Celsus the Skeptic because he was so opposed to Christianity. Listen to what he says. He says, Jesus returned home. Now, he's talking about when Jesus went to Egypt, we think, and he returned home highly elated at possessing these powers. What powers? Oh, he believes that he went to Egypt to become a magician, and he returned home highly elated at possessing these powers, and on the strength of them, gave himself out to be a god. Now, what else does that say? Because you'll get skeptics that say, nobody believed that Jesus claimed to be God. Well, here you have the Romans saying, no, Jesus was trying to pass himself off as a god. He was telling people that he was a god. So which is it, right? So here you have Jesus, who comes home with all these magical abilities and gives himself off as a god. Now listen to what he says. It was by means of sorcery. There's that word again. What does sorcery mean? It means you're doing things that are supernatural that can't be explained by the natural world. And again, the Romans, like those Jews in the Talmud, is saying this is sorcery. It was wicked. It was by means of sorcery that he was able to accomplish the wonders which he performed. There's no doubt there. They don't say, which he may have performed, which we've heard he performed. No, it owns it. Yes, he performed these crazy things. Let us believe that these cures, check, Jesus did a lot of that. Or the resurrection. He performed 3 resurrections before his own. Or the feeding of a multitude with a few loaves. These aren't invented stories that come later. Here you have Celsus the Skeptic, the Roman, who's like, yep, cures, resurrection, feeding of a multitude with a few loaves. Those come straight out of the Gospels. But then he concludes these are nothing more than the tricks of jugglers. Like, have you seen the dead come to life from, like, David Copperfield? Like, no, this is way more than just magician stuff or sorcery. He claimed to be God because he was God. And the only way that the Romans could try to discredit him is to say, he did crazy stuff. We have to concede that because we're writing to audiences that are from towns where this stuff happened. But we're going to claim that it's just sorcery. What do you do with that?
Yeah, so it seems the PR firm that took control of this after the narrative is not trying to deny any truth that exists. It's just like you said, there's so much eyewitness testimony that they would have been laughed at, but it's to distort the truth.
Completely.
It's to say his supernatural abilities came from magic, and then he claimed to be God because of that, instead of what Christians believe is the exact opposite.
Yeah.
That he is God, so if he is God, then the supernatural powers would come automatically.
That's right. If he is God, you should expect the supernatural. And that's why it turned the world upside down. People from all over these villages had seen this stuff with their own eyes, and it caused great upheaval in that region. And to the point, like, they have discovered other things. Like, for example, down in Egypt, after the resurrection and the ascension of Christ into heaven, in the aftermath, word of this miracle worker went all over the world to where down in Egypt, they found ancient wares like cups and bowls where you see inscribed on them, through Christ the magician. So you'd have magicians that were down in Egypt that are like, he is the buzz of all the world. This guy has done amazing things. I have that same power. So come to me and I'll make a potion that's through Christ the magician. And so you'd have these people that are citing Jesus. And again, what do they not deny? They certainly don't deny that this guy ever existed. So that's absurd. But they don't deny that there was something really different about him that nobody could explain in the natural order. So he's miraculous, and he existed. That's really fascinating. Another guy that we find who wrote about this is a guy named Quadratus, who was a bishop of Athens. And listen to what he says, because he makes a compelling argument here. He doesn't say, hey, trust me, this stuff happened. Listen to what he says. Our Savior's works, moreover, were always present, for they were real, consisting of those who had been healed of their diseases, those who had been raised from the dead, who were not only seen while they were being healed and raised up, but were afterwards constantly present. Nor did they remain only during the sojourn of the Savior on earth, but also a considerable time after his departure, and indeed some of them have survived even down into our times. So here you have Quadratus, who we know died in 129 AD. Let's say he's born in 60. He lived, 69 years or something. When he's born, the people who had received miraculous works, who were raised from the dead, who ate the multiplied loaves and fish, are still around. And he's like, man, I remember talking with some of these people. They were around when I was a kid, even into our times. And what do you not find as an objection to Quadratus?
No, he didn't.
So they're writing about all of these things to an audience that's not saying this never happened. You will not find the early skeptic who says Jesus never existed. This is entirely made up. This was a myth created out of nowhere, and he definitely didn't do the miraculous. These are all made up. This is all exaggerated. All the arguments for him and against him said he existed and he did pretty crazy stuff that had a massive impact on the world. I don't know how the skeptic answers that. And so just like Quadratus is a bishop, so he's favorable toward Christianity. But you have guys like Josephus, who's writing in the first century, who's working for Rome as a historian. And listen to what he says about Jesus. He says, at this time, there was a wise man called Jesus. Now, by the way, he is a Jew. He does not like the spread of Christianity, but he acknowledges there was a guy, Jesus. And he says his conduct was good and he was known to be virtuous. Many people among the Jews and the other nations became his disciples. Pilate condemned him to be crucified and to die. So it's like, check, 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 check. The Bible's all over this. But those who had become his disciples did not abandon his discipleship. Gee, why not? Well, Josephus goes on. He says, they reported that he appeared to them 3 days after his crucifixion and that he was alive. Accordingly, he was perhaps the Messiah concerning whom the prophets have reported wonders, and the tribe of Christians, so named after him, has not disappeared to this day. So you've got voices, friendly and foe, that don't deny his existence, and now are saying there's reports going all over the place that he was raised from the dead and people followed after him.
So as we're tracking here in this episode, we're seeing that, against the skeptic's argument, we're seeing that not only was there a historical Jesus, but we have things like the Babylonian Talmud coming to us and saying, okay, there was a Jesus who was crucified under Pontius Pilate, things like that. Plus this whole Celsus the Skeptic with sorcery coming up and magic seeming to be the whole thing, and seeing magicians down in Egypt trying to hop on the bandwagon of Jesus the magician. And then Quadratus stating, like, you can't even deny this because here he is in the early 100s saying, oh no, I've spoken to people who saw these things.
Yeah, that's right.
Children who are around with the feeding of the 5,000, hey, they're still here. And they're saying, hey, we saw this with our own eyes. And even a guy like Flavius Josephus, who's not with Jesus, who's a Jew, who's writing for Rome, saying, okay, just track the story of the Bible outside of the Gospels, that there was a Jesus, that he was a virtuous man who was crucified under the hands of Pontius Pilate. And it starts to stack up saying,
okay, that he was raised.
And that he was raised.
And that people are following him, claiming that he had been raised from the dead. Those are big claims that match exactly what the Bible was saying. And the skeptics will come and say, okay, you know, the Bible claims that Jesus was given a proper burial after he was crucified. Well, one of the arguments that was around was that they would not have buried criminals and given them a formal burial. And just recently, and this is kind of cool just because you get to see the remains of a crucified person, but here was somebody whose name was Yohanan, son of Hagakol, totally unknown figure of history, who was crucified for criminality and was given a proper burial, and we find his remains in a proper burial. And so that argument doesn't hold weight. But you even get beyond that, and there's evidence that gets outside of even things that rely on human opinions, right? So, like, the Bible comes along, and it'll claim that some supernatural things happened during the crucifixion, one of which is that when Jesus is on the cross, there's a great earthquake that causes the temple veil to be torn in two. Then there's aftershocks or tremors or earthquakes that happen on the morning of the resurrection as well. And you think, well, gee, is there any evidence of that in history? And you go to the International Geology Review, and guess what they find? They find that there was a massive earthquake that hit right near the Dead Sea, 13 miles away from Jerusalem, and that earthquake had to land between the years of 26 and 36 AD. Can you think of another event that happened in that time range? That's the crucifixion of Jesus, and that there's evidence of this massive seismic activity, just like the Bible says. When's the last time you've heard of a massive earthquake in Israel? In your lifetime? Do you remember any? So here you have archaeological evidence, geological evidence of an earthquake that was so massive that we can still find evidence of it 2,000 years later. And oh, by the way, when the Bible comes and the prophets talk about the moon turning to blood on the great day of the Lord, the crucifixion, right? Well, that's not just like weird prophetic talk. Oh, the moon turned to blood. It's actually a real term that sailors would use, that when there was a partial lunar eclipse, the way that the light redshifts around the earth, it makes the earth, or makes the moon look red. And so they would call it a blood moon. And so I can't forge this, but if you go into the records of NASA and you go to the day that Jesus is crucified, because there's only two options, everybody agrees on this. We know that he's crucified on Passover, which lands on a Friday, so that limits things. We know that it's during the reign of Pontius Pilate, so it has to be April 7th of 30 AD or April 3rd of 33 AD. We know that Pilate is spooked by Caesar, which means it had to have come after Tiberius starts putting the hammer down on other governors that are getting out of line, so it's probably the later option. And so when you look at NASA's records of April 3rd, 33 AD, guess what you find? You find a partial lunar eclipse that falls precisely on that day, and guess what time it goes into eclipse? When you look at the NASA records in military time, it's 14:55. What time would that be?
2:55.
2:55. What time was Jesus? What time did he die on the cross?
3 o'clock.
3 o'clock. The Bible tells us that he died at the ninth hour. They would count from 6 a.m., so at 3 o'clock, he dies, and the moon goes into partial eclipse, and the moon turns to blood. And you got to think, if you're one of those soldiers, and you've just experienced the earthquake, and you look up, and the moon is going red, you can understand why they're crying out, surely this man was the Son of God. And you have people who write about it. Like, here's a guy whose name is Julius Africanus, who writes in 215 AD, and he's writing about a source that he's quoting that goes back just a couple of decades after Jesus. And this guy, Thallus, who wrote a couple of decades after Jesus, wrote this: on the whole world, there pressed a most fearful darkness, because we're told that it went dark for 3 hours. Couldn't have been a solar eclipse, because there's a lunar eclipse. You can't have both. So there's this weird darkness that falls on the land. And he writes, on the whole world, there pressed a most fearful darkness. And the rocks were rent by an earthquake, and many places in Judea and the other districts were thrown down. And so you have all of these people that are talking about supernatural, crazy things that are going on. Like, that's not forgery. That's not somebody coming along and saying, oh, let me write about that. These are things that are happening in the earth and in the sky that humans can't forge that fall right in line with what the Bible says is happening. And that also encourages our faith to trust the veracity of the New Testament.
I mean, we've looked at those quotes of those other guys, but I think one of the greatest things to really implant that Jesus was real is the response of the disciples, that these 12 men who followed after Jesus for, and they gave up 3 years of their life and a lot to do. Okay, Jesus is crucified, resurrected, and ascended into heaven. So what did they do from there? Because we know Judas hangs himself. We know John's the only one not to die a martyr's death, but at least 10 other guys who are willing to die for what they believed was true.
That's right. You go to the historical sources and you find that each and every one of those remaining 10 apostles, and even the one that comes along to replace Judas, they're all going to be martyred. The gospel writer Mark, going to be martyred. Luke, going to be martyred. And here's what's fascinating about that. You could say, well, there's martyrs in every faith that give themselves up. Yeah, but let's say that the suicide bomber, he believes what he's doing. He believes that God is going to reward him for what he's about to do and give up his life, right? That's different than the apostles, because the apostles are claiming, I saw the risen Jesus with my own eyes, which means they absolutely 100%, this isn't about faith anymore. They got to see with their own eyes the risen Jesus, or they absolutely knew that it was a lie. They knew that it was a lie, or it was true, and they all went and died. That should suggest that what they died for, they believed in the depths of their soul, which means they really saw the risen Jesus. And one of my, it wasn't just the apostles that had this wild reaction. And here's one of my favorite tools, what's called apologetics, to support the faith. If we were walking down the street, right, and let's say we're walking this way, and then all of a sudden, a mob of just thousands of people are running, screaming, terrified, and they're all running that way. What do you immediately assume?
Something terrible has happened over there.
That's right. Something really amazingly shocking is going on that way, and we should probably go this way. Mm-hmm. And that's what you find in the first century and the second century in response to Jesus. It's turning everything upside down. And so let's talk about that, because we find this is where we're gonna lean on the Bible for a moment. We've been outside of the Bible with all this other stuff. But let's lean on the Bible for some clues, and then we'll go back outside of the Bible. In the book of Acts, when you get to the celebration of Pentecost, this is something that's really important to understand. When Jesus is crucified, it's on Passover. It's a big feast for the Jewish people. 50 days later, you get to another feast called Pentecost. Both of those feasts, it's required for Jews, no matter where you live, the men, to come back to Jerusalem to the temple to celebrate these massive feasts. So when Jesus is crucified at Passover, huge population in Jerusalem. Huge population is hearing about resurrection and crucifixion of a guy who claimed to be the Messiah. News of that, buzz of that's going to be everywhere. 50 days later, when they come back, now all of a sudden you've got all these witnesses that claim to have seen the risen Jesus. Everything is buzzing, right? And you get this moment where Jesus has said, I want you to stay in Jerusalem to his disciples, and I'm going to send the Spirit. Now listen to the way it sets this up. It says, there were dwelling in Jerusalem Jews, devout men from every nation under heaven. So all those Jews that were scattered around in the Babylonian exile, they're still coming back to the temple. And listen to the list. Parthians and Medes and Elamites and residents of Mesopotamia, Judea and Cappadocia and Pontus and Asia and Phrygia and Pamphylia. Are you exhausted yet? Egypt and parts of Libya belonging to Cyrene, visitors from Rome, both Jews and proselytes, Cretans and Arabians. The author of Acts, which is Luke, what he wants you to understand is there's people from all over the world that have come to Jerusalem that are witnessing what's going on. And Peter gives a sermon, and what's his entire sermon about? Jesus is raised from the dead. The prophets, everything they wrote about has come true. He's out there saying, David foresaw and spoke about the resurrection of the Christ, that he was not abandoned to Hades, nor did his flesh see corruption. And listen to his argument. He says, this Jesus God raised up, and of that, we all are witnesses. Like, you don't make that argument unless the people are like, yeah, we did see this. And the way that Luke describes these people coming from all different nations, I want you to see a graphic of the map of what he's describing. That they're coming from every single direction. They're seeing this. They're experiencing this. They see the supernatural work of the Spirit performing miracles at Pentecost. And guess what? They all go back home. And it's like this massive explosion of the gospel that is taking place 50 days after Jesus' crucifixion and resurrection narrative. And they all go back home. And guess what they're going to be talking about when they go back to their synagogues? You wouldn't believe what we saw in Jerusalem. The Messiah has come. He's defeated sin and death. He was raised. There were witnesses. We experienced the miraculous. They go back home to their synagogues, and this is where it gets exciting. The gospel starts exploding right away. And so here's another challenge that, like me, because I'm a natural skeptic, I want to know, like, is this faith a reasonable faith? Well, you go and all the skeptics will tell you that the first gospel, the earliest gospel, is the gospel of
Mark.
Mark. And they'll say it was probably written, probably at the earliest, somewhere around 60 AD, which means we have a few decades where the gospel didn't exist. Well, if I'm a skeptic and I believe that they just invented the gospel,
yeah,
right? They made it up out of whole cloth. Jesus didn't exist. He never did the miraculous. Then there should be no Christianity before 60 AD, before that first gospel is invented, before Mark has invented Christianity, right? And that's, you see the exact opposite. So when Paul, everybody agrees that Paul wrote before you get to the Gospels. In fact, he's going to be martyred by Nero not long after these Gospels start circulating. But in 50 AD, when he writes the letter to the Thessalonians, listen to what he says. He praises them because, quote, their faith in God has gone forth everywhere. How has their faith in God gone forth everywhere if the Gospels hadn't been invented yet? Or when he writes to the Romans in 57 AD, what's he saying? He's commending them because their faith was being reported all over the world. How? Why? Where did they get this? The evangelists? Like, Paul hasn't gone and done his missionary journeys yet. How in the world is this faith spreading all over the place unless the source of this news wasn't Paul and it wasn't the apostles? It was those early eyewitnesses that went back. That's why Luke is telling you they came from all these places, because they went home to all these places with the news. And the gospel's just exploding everywhere, even before you have the gospels being penned. And so in 62 AD, when Paul's writing on house arrest in Rome, listen to what he says to the Colossians. He says that their faith is being, he says, all over the world, this gospel is bearing fruit and growing. During his missionary journeys, the enemies that are recorded in the Bible are claiming that the gospel has turned the world upside down. Paul is being on trial. And what do you find when you go through the book of Acts? What is Paul's reception? Every town he goes to.
Not good.
Not good. So let's walk through it real quick. In Damascus, I'm just going to give direct quotes. In Damascus, the Jews plot to kill him. In Jerusalem, they were seeking to kill him. In Pisidia, they attacked him and drove him out. In Iconium, they sought to stone him. In Lystra, they actually did stone him and leave him for dead. In Philippi, he's beaten with rods and jailed. Like, do you do this for a myth and just keep going? Like, this is so precious, I can't stop. In Thessalonica, a violent mob drove him out. In Berea, crowds stirred up against him. In Athens, they mocked the resurrection. In Corinth, they opposed and reviled him. In Ephesus, they're rioting against his teachings. And what is the teachings? God the Son became a man. He conquered sin and death. He rose from the dead, ascended into heaven, and he is Lord of all. And when he would go into these towns and preach that message in the synagogue, it would stir up riots. Okay, that's what the Bible tells us, Sam. Is that really true? When Paul goes on trial, Tertullus, who's the prosecuting attorney, says, listen to the language. We have found this man a plague. The Jews had handed him over. They wanted him done. We have found this man a plague, one who stirs up riots among all the Jews throughout the world and is a ringleader of a sect of the Nazarenes. Why call them Nazarenes? Because they follow Jesus of
Nazareth.
Nazareth. Okay, so we get this impression. There's riots and everything else, and it's a ringleader, and, you know, we find this man a plague. Hang on to that language. Now let's go outside of the Bible. You have Paul, who's claiming it's because of the resurrection that I'm even on trial. And so then you find the Roman world beginning to respond to all these, the riots that are stirring up all over the world because of Christianity and its message. So then in 42 AD, you have the emperor of Rome, who's a guy named Claudius, that is finding all the Jews in all these towns are getting upset and they're starting off riots, right? So, for example, he sends an edict down to the city of Alexandria, which had a massive Jewish population. And what does he say in that? I don't want any more Jews coming to you from Syria. Why? What's wrong with the Jews that are coming from that region of Israel and Palestine? Like, why would you not want any more migrant Jews coming from that region? What are they coming with? They're coming with a message that's causing people to get stirred up. What might that message be? I wonder. So he says, no more. You're not allowed to have any more who come here. That same Claudius is cited in the Bible in Acts chapter 18, 2, that he sent all of the Jews out of Rome. He required all the Jews to be expelled from Rome. And that's not just a biblical claim. You go outside of the Bible and you find a Roman historian named Suetonius, and he describes it, and he even gives the reason for it. He says, since the Jews of Rome were indulging in constant riots at the instigation of Christus, which is the Latin version of the name Christ, he expelled them from the city. So let me ask you a question. You have Claudius, who reigns on the throne from 41 AD to 54 AD, and it's already becoming, when are the Gospels penned again? They still haven't been written yet. Christianity hasn't been invented yet. And you have the emperor sending letters saying, stop these missionaries coming from Syro-Palestine. Jews, get out of Rome because of all these riots that are being stirred up here about Christ. How did that happen? Where did this news come from? And oh, by the way, if we're talking about 41 to 54 AD, that means that you're within a couple of decades. There's so many eyewitnesses. If you wanted to stamp out the claims of Christianity, my goodness, just ask. Everybody's still around, but they can't. They can't produce a body and they can't stamp it out. Why? Because these eyewitnesses are not only unwilling to deny it, they're willing to give their life for it. So here's another one that I think is just fascinating. This also comes from Claudius, 41 to 54 AD. Remember the time. This is called the Nazareth inscription. Now, what is Nazareth in the Bible?
It's the childhood home of Jesus.
That's right. This is where, so Jesus of Nazareth, this is where his childhood home was. This is where he grew up. But it's a podunk town. Like when people talk about the Messiah came from Nazareth, what's the response? Can anything good come from Nazareth? It's like it's a tiny town in the sticks. Like nothing good comes from there, right? So here you have an inscription, an edict from Caesar that was from Nazareth. And I just want to ask you to stop and think about Caesar finding a problem so significant that he makes an inscription and sends it to Nazareth. Oh, and gee, I wonder what is this inscription about? Well, let's read it. Edict of Caesar. If anyone who has in any manner extracted those who have been buried or has moved with wicked intent, those who have been buried to other places, committing a crime against them, or has moved sepulchre sealing stones against such a person, I wish that violator to suffer capital punishment. So again, the emperor of Rome is running into such a problem with news about some tomb being empty, some stone being rolled away, a body not being found where it's supposed to be, that he issues an edict, and that edict is discovered in Nazareth? Why do you suppose that is? And again, the point of this is to say the buzz of Christianity, the news that somebody is not in a tomb anymore, is causing big problems. Big problems for Caesar, to where he's saying, stop the missionaries. I want the Jews to leave Rome. I'm going to send out edicts that you're not allowed to move bodies if I find that you're doing that, because he doesn't believe in the resurrection, but he knows he has a problem because of an empty tomb, and he wants it stamped out. What do you make of that? Like, put on your skeptic hat. How do you explain this away?
So what other evidence do we have of Christianity spreading before the Gospels were written?
Well, probably one of the most famous events that happens in the city of Rome during the first century is the Great Fire. Like you hear, you know, Nero fiddling while Rome burns, right? Well, that happens in 64 AD. And there's actually quite a lot written about the history of what happened in the aftermath of those fires, because guess who Nero is going to blame? He's going to blame the Christians. Okay, so now pause. Jesus dies in 33 AD. They're saying that the first gospel's not penned till 60. The city of Rome catches fire in 64 AD, and Nero is blaming the Christians that are just brand new. You know, like,
yeah.
So, but listen to the way that it's described, and you get the impression Christianity's not a new thing to Rome in 64 AD. Only 3 decades, and it's already a major sect that they're having to deal with. So, Suetonius, who's one of the historians, writes that punishment by Nero was inflicted on the Christians, a class of men given to a new and mischievous superstition. And this is going to be kind of Roman speak for the resurrection, this new and mischievous superstition. That's the resurrection. That death doesn't have the final word over Christians anymore is referred to as this superstition. So another one who talks about this is a guy named Tacitus. And Tacitus was a Roman historian. He's probably one of the most respected historians of Rome that we have of this era. And listen to what he says, because he basically just walks you through a lot of the major claims of the Gospels. And he's like, well, yes, yes, yes. Listen to this. To get rid of the report that he was to blame for the fire, Nero fastened the guilt and inflicted the most exquisite tortures on a class hated for their abominations called Christians by the populace. Christus, there it is again, that's the Latinized way of saying Christ. Christus, from whom the name had its origin, suffered the extreme penalty. What's that? That's crucifixion. During the reign of Tiberius, at the hands of one of our procurators, Pontius Pilate. So check, like how many checks of the gospel are there? And a most mischievous superstition. There it is again. It's almost like all the Romans got together and said, okay, here's the talking points on how we deal with Christianity. It's a plague. We've seen that word thrown around a lot. And it's a mischievous superstition, this idea of a resurrection. So he says, a most mischievous superstition, thus checked for the moment, broke out not only in Judea, the first source of the evil, but even in Rome, where all things hideous and shameful from every part of the world find their center and become popular. Right? So he doesn't have a high opinion of the politics of Rome. But listen to what he said. Don't miss this. He says it was checked for the moment and it broke out again. So in 64 AD, they had had a great uprising of Christianity that they had to check, and now it broke out again. So it's not a new thing on the block in 64 AD. And oh, by the way, listen to what he says. He says, accordingly, an arrest was first made of all who pleaded guilty. Then upon their information, an immense multitude was convicted. So there's an immense multitude of Christians in Rome. How? If the Gospels are brand new in 64 AD, how in the world is there an immense multitude of Christians in Rome? Well, what's the answer? They weren't waiting around for the Gospels to be written. Eyewitnesses came back to Rome and the gospel exploded there long before the gospels were penned or Paul is going to come and visit. He says, mockery of every sort was added to their deaths. Covered with the skin of beasts, they were torn by dogs and perished, or were nailed to crosses, or were doomed to the flames and burnt to serve as nightly illumination when daylight had expired. And so here you have these Roman voices that are saying, yeah, in 64 AD, big problem with Christians that Nero had to face. And then the question is, where did these Christians come from? What were their sources? Why were they giving themselves to Jesus at that time when the Gospels had not circulated yet?
So it's amazing that we get to look back at, say, all of these Romans that were writing back in ancient times about what we're discussing. But do we have anything maybe more modern that we can find?
Yeah, there's other evidence that archaeologists have found that's kind of interesting. So, like, for instance, Jesus, when he ascends into heaven, he ascends at a place called Bethany. And the prophecy is that he's going to return the way he went. And so a lot of people from Bethany, which is, you know, where Mary and Martha and Lazarus were, where Jesus would stay oftentimes, they would bury themselves, and they've discovered ossuary boxes that predate 70 AD, so that are within a few decades of Jesus, that have Cairo symbols on them, which is, you know, that would be an abbreviation for the Christ. They find crosses in them. They find references to resurrection, like on them they'll be inscribed, Divine Jehovah, raise up, raise up. One of the more fascinating ones is on one of these ossuary boxes, you find a fish that's inscribed on it with the image of a man that's being spat up out of the fish. And the whole idea of that is Jonah. You know, Jesus says that the resurrection is going to be the sign of Jonah, for just as Jonah was in the belly of a fish for 3 days, the Son of Man's going to be in the belly of the earth for 3 days, but then they're raised up. Well, on these ossuary boxes, you find images of the ichthus, or the fish, that are inscribed on them. So you find evidence right in those early decades that people are associating resurrection with fish, and Yeshua is inscribed on the ossuaries, which is the name of Jesus. So you find a lot of references where people are now putting their own hopes in that region in the resurrection of Jesus to bring about their own hope for resurrection and an afterlife. And it's no secret that the letters are going to continue, that the Roman emperors are going to be trying to stamp out Christianity, and they're going to fail. At the end of the first century, one of the emperors was named Trajan, and he wants Christianity to be stamped out. So he starts telling all of his governors, I want you to get rid of Christianity. And one of the guys, Pliny the Younger, writes back to him, and he's like, I don't think you understand what you're asking us to do. These people worship this Jesus. This is the turn of the first century. He writes to the emperor, these people sang a hymn to Christ as to a god and bound themselves by solemn oath not to do any wicked deeds, but never to commit any fraud, theft, or adultery, and never to falsify their word. So you'll hear from skeptics like, oh, you know, they didn't even codify that Jesus was God until the Council of Nicaea, which is absurd and totally wrong. Here you have him saying, no, they were already worshiping Jesus as God. So he goes on, he's like, before I put all these people to death, I therefore postpone the investigation and hasten to consult you, for the matter seemed to me to warrant consulting you, especially because of the number involved. And then listen to how much Christianity had spread even within that first century. He says, for many persons of every age, every rank, and also of both sexes are and will be endangered, for the contagion of this superstition, there it is again, has spread not only to the cities, but also to the villages and the farms. So you have Pliny who's telling Trajan, this is everywhere. People are coming. And by the way, again, this is within still the first century, where there's a lot of eyewitness testimony and generational memory that could have been challenged on this. Or you find the Roman playwright Lucian, who's talking about what Christians believed in those early days. And he says, the Christians worship a man. Now, what does that mean? Why would you worship a man? You believe that man is
God.
God. The Christians worship a man to this day, the distinguished personage who introduced their novel rites and was crucified on that account. Again, that's validation of the biblical claims. Then he goes on, because he's not a fan of Christians. Listen to what he says. He says, these misguided creatures, that's what we are, Will, misguided creatures, they start with the general conviction that they are mortal for all time. We are immortal for all time. Death has no claim on us. Why would these misguided creatures say that? Because they've seen that their Savior has conquered death, and that gift is now given to us. And therefore, death has no claim on us because we worship the one who's conquered death for us. And so he goes on, he says, it was impressed on them by their original lawgiver that they are all brothers from the moment that they are converted and deny the gods of Greece and worship the crucified sage and live after his laws. All this they take quite on faith, with the result that they despise all worldly goods alike and regard them merely as common property. And so here you have all these voices. Nobody's challenging whether Jesus existed. In fact, they're validating the fact that he was crucified, that lots of people believed and saw that he had risen from the dead, that they're living their lives, their entire lives. They're giving their lives on the certainty that this Jesus was real and did the things that the Gospels claim that he did. And the Romans are in awe that these people live differently. And by faith, we're invited into that same confidence that death and sin and shame and guilt does not have the final word over Will or over Sam. We start with the conviction that because Jesus is who he said he was, that sin and death have no claim over us, and that we too are immortal for all time. And all the trinkets and failures and challenges of this life do not have the final word over us. Jesus does. And in that, we have incredible liberty, and we can be confident he existed and he is who he said he is.
Amen. Thanks so much for watching, and don't forget to like, comment, and subscribe, or even to share this video with a friend if you enjoyed it. And join us next time as we go under the hood of another story in the Bible.